Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company that enables you to improve your mental health from anywhere at any time. Get matched with a licensed therapist from over 2,000 choices and message them whenever you need to. No commutes and no judgments. For a special offer for our listeners, visit Talkspace.com/freak and use the code FREQ to get $45 off your first month and show your support for this show. Talkspace, it's therapy for how we live today.
Oh, Ebony, I have a pop culture check-in and I can't even wait for the show to start.
Carol, I think I know where you're going with this.
Ebony, you and I, we have a new podcast called Cinema Ball, premiering Friday, April 27th.
That's right, and this is the podcast we have always wanted to make, Carol. We made it happen. Basically, we're going to get together every week, talk about movies, and play a game in which the points don't really matter by connecting one film to another.
Exactly. It's going to be fantastic. Gosh, do you think Phil is going to mind that we're talking about this now?
I think we're fine. Also, I don't care. As long as we end this conversation with... And now, please enjoy episode 22 of Feminist Frequency Radio.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 22, and I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian. I'm joined by my very own Coachella backup dancers, Carolyn Pettit.
Hey, hey.
And Ebony Astor.
I want my own headlining set.
Done. This is a show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. On today's show, we're going to talk about the hit new horror film, A Quiet Place, and discuss the premiere episode of the brand new espionage series, Killing Eve, starring Sandra Oh. As always, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Exclusively for our fantastic drip backers, we'll be recording a bonus segment. This week, we're each going to talk about some media we absolutely love while simultaneously acknowledging that it's pretty problematic. Everything Feminist Frequency produces, including this very podcast, is listener, reader, and fan-supported. Thank you for helping us stay on the air and on the web. If you want access to special perks and exclusive backer awards, join our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. Now on with the show. What is up, everybody?
What's up?
So,
I am exhausted from all of my Coachella work supporting you the way I always do with... on the ones and the twos. Oh my God.
Well, okay. Let's just go right into the
pop culture news
and talk about Beyonce's performance at Coachella this weekend. So I don't think any of us actually watched it or saw it, unfortunately. I mean, I have not
had a chance to watch it. No.
Yeah. But, I think all of our Twitter feeds were just blowing up with reactions to it. By all accounts, a really phenomenal performance. And in lieu of, talking about our firsthand impressions, I want to share a few little excerpts from the New York Times review of the performance, which I think does a really excellent job of putting it in its historical context as a performance. So this is... from the review by John Caramanica. Apologies if I'm not pronouncing that correctly. He starts out by saying, let's just cut to the chase. There's not likely to be a more meaningful, absorbing, forceful, and radical performance by an American musician this year or any year soon than Beyoncé's headlining set at the Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival on Saturday night. It was rich with history, potently political, and visually grand. By turns uproarious, rowdy, and lush, a gobsmacking marvel of choreography and musical direction. He goes on to note... this significant detail. It started with the horns, trumpets, trombones, sousaphones. For most of the night, the 36-year-old star was backed by an ecstatic marching band in the manner of historically black college football halftime shows. The choice instantly reoriented her music, sidelining its connections to pop and framing it squarely in a lineage of southern black musical traditions, from New Orleans' second-line marches to Houston's chopped and screwed hip-hop. This is a great moment. Okay. Thank you for allowing me to be the first black woman to headline Coachella, she said mid-set, then added an aside that was, in fact, the main point, ain't that about a bitch?
Exactly.
And finally, this is the final line, or the final two lines of the review. Like no other musician of her generation apart from Kanye West... Beyoncé is performing musicology in real time. It is bigger than any tribute she might receive. History is her stage. So, like,
say I that. Mean, oh, I'm to, over, to here, call, I'm over like, here snapping my fingers. Say yeah, that.
I mean,
John Crackhammer, yeah, whatever your name is.
Right on.
I'm going to let the New York Times cook for one more week, even though that the gray lady, you know, needs to take a step back.
I got to see this shit, man. That night, I went to bed early and woke up in the middle of the night and was looking at Twitter and was like my entire Twitter feed was blowing up, just being like, that was the blackest shit I've ever seen. Just like everyone was talking about how amazing it was and how great it was. And I was like, God damn it.
I know.
Like,
yeah, you texted me telling me you were going to bed. She was like, is it too early to go to bed? And I'm like, bitch, I'm already in bed. Why are you asking me? So you know I haven't seen it yet. Yeah. I'll watch it with my chamomile tea underneath the quilt, you know, at around noon.
I know. I was like, oh, I'll just catch it later, whatever. And I it's not. Someone's got to have it somewhere.
It will.
I saw a lot of clips of it on Instagram.
Sure.
Stories. So, you know, I feel like I don't feel like anything. All right. The first main topic that we want to discuss today is A Quiet Place. It's a new horror film by John Krasinski, which, for those of you who are like me and never watched The Office because weren't really big fans of The Office, he's the dude from The Office, which I didn't, yep, even after.
Oh, my God.
Even after we finished watching it, Carolyn was like, oh, it was directed by John Krasinski. I was like, uh-huh. Like, I had no idea. I didn't know that that was the name of the guy who starred in it. I didn't know that it was the same director.
Oh my God.
And I didn't know
that
he was
fired from this podcast? This is ridiculous.
Yeah. What did y'all think?
I think it's a very effective movie going experience. Like, when I was at the theater, I was into it. Though there are some things about it that I am less fond of thinking about it in retrospect. But first, to start off with what I think is really fascinating about the film, you know, is, like, so often in films, like, even when characters are ostensibly supposed to be whispering to each other, they do it in kind of a stage whisper so that we, the audience, can still hear it. So they'll be like, you know, shh, be quiet. But, like, they're barely whispering. Like, we can still totally hear them. What was so fascinating to me about this film is, like, they really don't make a sound. Like, they are so quiet to each other. It's like they are truly trying to not make a sound. And I thought that was, it's just so kind of novel to go to a film where the characters, I mean, they communicate, of course, through, like, sign language and through, like, really quiet whispers. But you really don't hear them. And of course, I love the way that expands to other aspects of their lives.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Amy framed Nick for her own murder.
They need to be super quiet all the time because any noise attracts killer alien creatures of some sort.
Dark angels.
And so, like, even the family's, attempts at maintaining some, you know, if you can even call it normalcy in this, like, extreme experience of life are impacted by this. Like, for instance, there's a moment where they're playing Monopoly and the pieces are, like, they've replaced the, you know, the car and the boot and the like pewter pieces with, like, felt, you know, or like very soft pieces. And so that, in that sense, like, the world building and just the commitment to the concept of needing to maintain silence, I thought was really cool.
I loved how the movie took care to show the distinction between the different types of silence experienced by the Abbotts, the majority of the family, versus the young girl whose name I just forgot.
The actor who plays her is Millicent Simmons,
who
is actually a deaf actor.
Exactly. And it's just, she has the most emotive, luminous, cherubic face. Like, I loved looking at her. Y'all know that I spend, you know, a good 67% of my time on any podcast episode trashing child actors. I'm happy not to be able to do that in this episode.
Yeah, like, I love, I was thinking that too.
All of them, right? But the way the movie removes sound from the picture when we're seeing things from Millicent's perspective, I mean, whatever her character's name is, versus the slight ambient sound that's heard by her parents or her brother. I just thought that was really effectively done. And obviously, yeah, you know, this whole thing should be spoiler alerted, but, you know, her experience with sound, marginal as it is, it becomes a huge plot point later.
Yeah. I really liked the movie, and I hate horror movies a lot. Like, I was like, I want to see it because it... I love Emily Blunt. She's probably one of my favorite actors, like, contemporary actors, and I will see anything that she's in. But I don't like horror movies. And, like, yeah, this movie has jump scares, and it has shit. Like, the scene... We've already spoiler alerted, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, the scene where she's about to give birth, and that fucking... the nail is sticking up on the stairs. Carolyn and I were both like cringing so hard and like squirming in our seats and being like, oh, God, I hate. Yeah. I aged 20 fucking years just watching this goddamn movie. So, OK, first of all, can we talk about how quickly she gave birth? Because that shit is not how birth happens.
I mean, I don't know.
I feel like with the stress of a... thing trying to eat you, you probably would shoot that thing out, you know? You'd be like,
from my doctor friends, I do understand that subsequent births often are at least somewhat faster than the initial
birth.
Yeah, but
not like 20 minutes.
No, absolutely. I'm gonna let that pass.
Totally. And that the scene with the hand on the fucking bloody hand on the shower window was such an homage to all of this shit, right?
God.
Okay, but here's the thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if seeing this in the... So I think seeing it in the theater is a great idea because the sound design is fucking spectacular. But seeing it in a theater is the worst idea because people are noisy as fuck in movie theaters and usually the sound is so loud. So, you know, I love the Draft House. It's like my favorite theater to go to. Having the servers walking up and down the aisles, having people eating like the fucking like fried chicken and shit while we're watching this movie. And then in the middle of it, at some point, we could hear the movie from the other theater.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
I was like, what in the fuck? It was the most distracting shit. And so all of the tweets about this movie and how like kind of hard it is to see in theaters are really funny. There's one from Ryan Califf, who I think is a reporter, wrote, "Turns out the true horror of A Quiet Place is other people's mouth noise." And like in our theater, not only were people chomping down real loud and like slurping and shit, but they also were freaking out very vocally. So like in the moments of like tension, there was one or two people in the theater that were like, "Oh shit, oh shit," really loud. And I kept being like, oh my God, you're going to kill us. You're going to get us killed if you talk out loud.
I thought that was, I actually love that as part of a, it was it was like we were participating in some communal confirmation that none of our dumbasses would have survived in this world because we are so incapable of being silent. Listen, let me back it up and tell you this. I love movies that posit that there's like a hardy band of survivors who, you know, managed to recreate some semblance of normalcy, eke out an existence after, you know, some apocalypse, some zombie invasion, some, you know, alien incursion, whatever. If that ever happens and y'all are worried about did I make it, the answer is no. Ebony did not make it. I'm going in the first motherfucking wave, okay? For one thing, because I don't want to survive to try and rebuild. But if I do survive, there's no way, and you can hear my loud ass telling you this, there's no way I would be able to not make any sound. Just generally, like, oh my God. I would have been dead so quick. So I love this movie and I love seeing it in the theater and, you know, having it confirmed for me that the rest of y'all dummies would also be dead because no one could manage to keep quiet for an hour and a half for a movie.
Yo, so I was actually thinking about that. So one of the things Carolyn said when we walked out of the theater was related to that Monopoly bit about how like they've had to de-sound like everyday items. And so
is that the technical term?
Yes, 100%. They serve like they don't have plates, right? They have like leaves that they serve the food on. And I was thinking about how like I would miss like crunchy food so bad.
Oh boy.
You'd have to eat like fish every day or whatever. Like you just have to eat like things that don't make any noise.
Can I mention something? This made me laugh so hard. So I saw this movie last night, and after I saw it with my partner, he was like, "Oh, what'd you think?" Whatever, and I was like, "You're gonna hate me." But one of the main takeaways from this movie for me was when after the two of them are in like the soundproof bunker, and then John Krasinski's character comes up and he pushes the mattress away from the cellar. There's a bunch of apples on top of the mattress, and I was like, apples, the loudest fucking fruit. I was like, okay, granted, I'm sure there is a limited amount of things they could eat, but it just made me laugh so hard, and I had to stifle it because they, like, are you going to have to go into the soundproof bumper every time you have a fucking apple? Clearly, that's what you have to do in this world. It made me laugh so hard.
So the thing is, this movie's been getting a lot of slack for plot holes and technical errors and shit, which I'm just like, whatever. It's a fun movie. Like, your brain.
The suspension of disbelief.
Yes, that. Yeah.
Wow.
That's what your brain.
Yeah.
God, Carol and I are like this. I read them and I was like, whatever, get over it. Like, it's a good fucking movie. But so here's the thing that I still, like, I will accept the premise of, like, tension of, like, getting pregnant and having a baby.
But I kept being like, it
could have been. So to me, I'm like, it was an accident, even though a lot of people are reading it not. And like, you could argue that they're also religious because they did like a prayer before they ate. People can do that without being religious, but that's usually a signifier, right?
Sure.
But like, it's not like doctors don't exist in the world. And if this is the future times, like, do abortions exist? But like, how would you find a doctor if you're relegated to only being able to walk?
The future times? It's 2020, right?
Yeah. So like, abortion should theoretically still be legal at that point.
I mean, so you have a sense that they're still part of a larger human society?
Yeah. I don't know. But I assume that like, you could still get medical help if there's a doctor nearby.
Yeah, I'm with those people who are like, you were in the pharmacy, get some condoms. Y'all are still fucking in this economy?
Yeah,
I don't think so.
Or use the pull-out method. There's lots of ways to not get pregnant.
That's what I'm saying. like, I get it. I get that there's clearly an element of they lost a child, and although they're not trying to replace him, they are trying to... in some sense, fill a hole that they recognize can never be filled, but they are, in a sense, trying to assert humanity and reassert the boundaries of their family and their autonomy, right? But still, when we saw the reveal that she was pregnant, I was like, y'all ain't got no business fucking when this is going on. Also, another thing, every time in the beginning when they showed the family outside, you know, like hanging up clothes on the clothesline or just walking along or whatever, I was thinking, listen, I don't leave my house now and there are, you know, angry monsters trying to kill me. You trying to get me to leave the house to hang up clothes on the clothesline when there's something that could eat my dumb ass at any point? Uh-uh. Nope. I'm telling you, I would not make it.
So the... Also, every time they did like the wide panning shots of the house and they turned the lights on, I was like, man, this looks like a beautiful Pinterest wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, it was like, it
where
was
are the
such
mason
a gorgeous
jars?
Space. Or, yeah, yeah, exactly. I mentioned this earlier, but I really like that they cast a deaf actor to play a deaf character. I think, you know, we talk a lot about representation and actually the characters, if there's a trans character, have it played by a trans actor. There are plenty in the world that you can choose from.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really awesome. I'll also say that one of my first thoughts, too, is like, well, boy, it's convenient that they all know sign language already when the apocalypse is happening and they can already communicate. Mm-hmm. But I do like what that did for the story, right? And what...
Yeah, I mean, clearly they were
talking about in terms of sound design and communication.
Right, like
and
they were uniquely positioned to survive because their family already had a communication infrastructure that allowed them to communicate well, right? Because they have this deaf daughter. And I did love that moment where the father is, you know, telling his daughter, look, I'm trying a new cochlear implant for you. I think, you know, I finally cracked it, whatever. And she says, it's not going to work. Stop, stop. And there's part of her saying, like, you know, like, this is something you want for me. This is not something I told you I needed, this or something that I wanted. He's so insistent that this is something that she must have. And yes, you know, he would say that it's about her protection, right? Like, she needs to have every tool at her disposal to survive in this world. But he's not involving her in that process. And that just, you know, is so illustrative of how disabled folks exist in our world, right? You know, people making decisions for them and saying, like, I can make things better for you without consulting them to say, is this something that you want?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that reading of that scene, which is what I think is actually happening. Because I was thinking about that too, in terms of, like, man, he's really pushing, like, that there's something wrong with her that needs to get fixed. And I hate that. Like, that's a narrative that the disabled community really rails against, in terms of, like, there's nothing wrong with us and how we are. There's something wrong with how you're interpreting and like expectations of us. Yeah, it's great.
My only little gripe with the film really is, I guess, that I was frustrated by the scene in which Emily Blunt's character tells her husband, like, in very kind of very clear terms, in no uncertain terms, like, you have to protect this family, in the sense that it seemed very much to me like, well, as the husband and father, as the man, like, it is your responsibility to do this. And which, I mean, again, like, if there were some sort of critique woven in, like I think there is in the scene where he's talking to his daughter about the cochlear implant, I'd be more okay with it. But it did feel, you know, and it did feel a little overly kind of traditional to me right there. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in the way that horror movies, and I've talked about this before, but in a way, every horror movie is about contamination and corruption. And often the thing that is being corrupted is the nuclear family and domesticity. And so this film is about, you know, the ways in which that unit has to fight off attacks from the outside. And it does depend upon a very kind of, you know, conservative, old school version of the family, right? Like, heterosexual family, father, mother, children, father as the protector, mother as the nurturer, etc. And so to me, that's why that moment that you're talking about, Caro, I kind of, you know, was pulled back a little bit. But then also, like, the very final scene, the image of Emily Blunt with the shotgun just seemed, like, tonally wrong after the way the film has been setting her up. I wasn't quite sure what the film was doing there.
Huh. Oh, that's interesting. I also hated that line in that moment. Like, that was one of the few times I got pulled out where I was like, oh, really? But there's a sense that this film is, like Ebony just said, like, it's very in line with horror traditions.
Absolutely.
As far as I am familiar. Like, this is not a genre I know very well. And it's very standard storytelling, right? She says that it's foreshadowing that he's going to die and he's going to sacrifice himself because he hears her words and blah, 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 blah. Which also, like, I think it's fine. Like, it's fine. I was actually sad that he died. Like, I was like, and of course you're going to create this tension. But I really did want the, like, resolution of the family together, even though that's not the best way to tell this story. But I think it's innovative in other ways, right? Like, the sound design and what it's like, the way that it's telling the story. So,
Yeah. I mean, I'm really, really glad that I saw it. I was not overly distracted at the draft house by other things. So I was just really into the film. But whether, you know, you watch it in the theater, you see it at home, I highly recommend it as a movie going or movie watching experience. It's incredibly intense and successful. It's not really a film in my mind that has, like, a lot of layers in the sense, like, that I feel any pull to see it again. And because I feel like, I saw it once. I got what it was doing. It did it super well, and I'm good. But I'm so glad I did see it that one time.
Yeah, totally.
Me too. And I don't know what trailers did y'all see before? Did you see the one for Traffic, and then the one for what is it called? Adrift.
Nope.
The one with Shailene Woodley. Because I think those were those are the ones I saw, and it was very interesting to have those two. Kind of thriller, horror, you know, dramatic movies, the trailers for those shown before A Quiet Place. I would love to talk about this later, because the ways in which certain kinds of horror get racialized in film are fascinating to me. So let's come back to that.
You know, Ebony, sometimes I just really, really need someone to talk to. And, you know, I hate to say it, but you're not always there for me.
I know. And I hate that I can't be there for you 24/7. But wouldn't it be great if there was a therapy service that was?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds fantastic. I mean, the idea of being able to get something off my chest whenever I need to talk about my everyday challenges at work or home, or, you know, sometimes just chat about life. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, and so that's why I'm so grateful that we can talk about the Talkspace platform, because they've got over 2,000 licensed therapists who are experienced in addressing life's challenges we all face. To match with a perfect therapist for a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, go to Talkspace.com/freak and use the code FREQ to get $45 off your first month and show your support for this show. That's FREQ and Talkspace.com/freak.
Killing Eve is our next topic.
It is.
So we all watched the premiere. Uh-huh. It is a show on BBC America, which it's available for exactly 71. No, well, today's Monday. It's available for 71 days today. Minus two is 69.
Nice.
So when this comes out on Wednesday, you'll have 69 days to watch it for
Will
free
you
on
quit
BBC
trying
America.
To act like nice.
I'm really proud that I did minus two in my head.
Yeah.
But anyways, Killing Eve is a new espionage show. It's like a drama, but also a comedy in some way. Like, there's comedic elements to it.
It's a show of contrast, in my opinion. It's really about these two very different women. And, yeah, and there's humor and drama in their lives, but also, like,
but it's,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's starring Sandra Oh, just from all the things that we've seen her in. She's wonderful. The reason I say that is because usually dramas like have a little bit of humor interspersed in them. Sure. Where this one, I kept being almost like taken off guard when Eve, Sandra's character, would be like goofy.
Yeah.
And like almost what I expect of Sandra Oh in her acting chops. I don't expect a lot of seriousness from her, but like it's sort of a serious show. So like the tone. I had a hard time getting into it because the tone kept like shifting kind of aggressively.
I mean, okay, so, you know, this is not a fair thing to bring to my experience of this show necessarily. But so I'm like a big fan of the show The Americans, which is very, has spy elements, but it's very much about like identity and everything. And like on that show, you know, you have these spies who sometimes use sex, you know, in their work to get information, to work a target. But it's not like fun or, you know, it's something that takes something out of them. Like it's work, and it kind of sucks that they have to do this. And in Killing Eve, the woman that Eve is so contrasted with is this, assassin named Villanelle, and who is like super kind of glamorous and really seems to me like a bit like the male fantasy of a female assassin, right? Like she's a little bit like the way that she really seems to enjoy the being maybe using like sex and her appearance and stuff in her work. And I don't know. I'm not to say that there aren't women, obviously, who do take pleasure in those things. Maybe I'm being a little unfair here, but I guess, like, so in the first scene where we see Villanelle, you know, She's in this place in Vienna, this little, like, eating gelato or something, and she's, like, making faces at this little girl, and she almost looks at a waiter in the place and studies his expression as if she's thinking, like, how do actual, like, normal humans who feel things and express things, and then she, like, mimics the guy's smile to the little girl, but then on her way out, she, like, smashes the little girl's gelato into her lap or whatever. And I'm like, that's a moment. But also, I'm also thinking
I fucking loved it.
I loved it, too,
because let
me just say why I didn't love it. Like, I'm already thinking in my head, why would an assassin who's in this place and is, like, trying to maintain, like, a super low profile do anything that might bring attention to herself? And so maybe I'm, like, overthinking it or just expecting it to be a kind of show that it's not interested in being. But that was my reaction to that moment. But, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think that the show is, it's very consciously playing with the spy genre. Right. So I think it's embracing the kind of inherent, imminent, you know, ludicrousness of the way we construct these, you know, espionage worlds and the people who conduct espionage. Because I think, you know, when you read about people who actually do, have histories in this business, are like, it's not at all glamorous. It's, you know, it's very workaday.
Right.
The people who are spies, you would not know them. They're not, you know, Hollywood attractive. They don't have, you know, bodies like Henry Cavill. Like, they look like, you know, accountants and stuff, right? So I think this show is playing with
what are you saying about accountants, Ebony?
I'm saying, and you can get at me at Ebony Aster. I'm saying, by and large, I don't think y'all look like Henry Cavill or Idris Elba, whatever. But I love that scene.
If you do, I think we need to hire a new accountant.
I know, right? I love that scene when they're in Vienna in the gelato shop, just purely because I love any scene in movies or TV where a sociopath is trying to mimic human expressions. I don't know why it delights me, but it always does. And I love that Villanelle is, like, angry at the kid for not acknowledging the work she initially did. Like, the girl recognizes that she was inauthentic with her grin before, and she's so mad that she had to work for it. And so, yeah, I mean, I was delighted by it. I absolutely love this show. I can't wait to keep watching it.
I mean,
see Sandra Oh's glorious, lustrous hair.
Yeah. Like, it's to me right now, it feels like two different shows, but the show starring Sandra Oh, that half of it, like, I am super into that show.
Yeah.
Like, I really dig her character. I dig this Carolyn woman who's, like, higher up in MI6 and who's clearly, like, recognizes that Eve is keen and smart and knows what's up and is, like, on the down low gonna bring her on as, like, a secret agent of some kind. Like, that actor playing that woman is fantastic, so serious and, like, just no nonsense. But the other thing, the other implausibility in this show to me is Villanelle's breasts are not that small. Let's be real. Okay? I mean, come on. Like, she's not, like, particularly flat-chested.
Right. Oh, that's hilarious.
Anyway.
So, but, yeah. I'm very curious about the show, and I would like to continue watching it, even though I don't have, I mean, like, I feel like all the things I'm about to say are kind of like, what's up, are negative, but I actually do, I'm very curious about it, and I'm interested in it, especially because the way it ends is that, like, the first episode is entirely set up for Sandra, for Eve to become a spy, right? And at the very end of the first episode, you're like, oh, this is what this is about.
Yeah, this
right?
is like where it actually yeah.
it's gonna
is
take
kind
off.
Of, yeah.
So my thing is with the villain character, like, you know, I think that she is kind of delightful to watch in her performance and in what she's doing, but I hate those characters. Like, and usually they're male characters. In terms of, like, the sociopathic, like, murderous spy, secret agent, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't find pleasure in watching that kind of one-dimensional brutality. The sort of tropiness of it. And I think that there is a, you know, like I could see the show potentially going into a place where it's a little more complex and she's a little more complex. But overall, I don't enjoy that.
I mean, I have to admit, I do. So this the first kill she commits, the one in Vienna, which we don't see happen, but we hear about it in the aftermath, is like she... You know, she like cuts an artery and maybe in his arm or something, like, but it's such a small cut that he neither him nor his girlfriend notice. And it's like Eve is like in awe of it. Like when they're at the briefing, she says, she actually says, cool. Mm-hmm. Like she has this kind of admiration for Villanelle's elegance, her technique. And I mean, I...
Except when she fucking mass murders everyone
in
the hospital.
Then what was that? Like, that just seems like a complete...
And when he was like, her handler was like, oh, make it look like a suicide, and she fucking slaughters everyone in sight.
Yeah, what happened there? I think she's bored, right?
They talked about this on the show. Like, she's bored, and she's getting a little cocky, and she, you know, is, like, doing different things.
One of the things, you know, that I think kind of... mitigates the you know use of or like the construction of you know the uber sexy lady spy or lady assassin kind of trope here is that moment when Villanelle goes into I assume her apartment opens a drawer and there's a bunch of tampons there, which something so quotidian and everyday we rarely actually see in media, right? Like tampons, you know, pads, whatever. And so it just kind of really firmly reminds us that she is a human woman. She's not just some sex bot, you know? And I love that. Like, it just seemed like a very light touch that conveyed everything about how, like, no matter how superhuman she might appear to be with her amazing, you know, assassin lady skills, nevertheless, there is a person inside of this, you know, kill robot shell.
Yeah. My ultimate favorite scene of the whole episode, which is also my life goals, is the woman... who's like her assistant, I guess. So when you first meet her and they're walking down the hallway and she's eating her croissant and Eve's like, hey, can I have half of that? And she's like, she holds it out and then she shoves the rest of it in her face.
Yep.
Like, haha. I was like, you're the best. And then she actually has an extra one in her purse to give her. Like, that, I want to be that person. Like,
you want to be the person who
just
has.
Delightful.
You want to. Be the person who actually brings people croissants, because you can do that for me anytime. I will be happy to.
I want to be the person who fucks with you, but is also nice about it.
Oh, you are that person. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So I'm just seeing myself.
And yet, I have not gotten a croissant from you. So,
well, because I don't really eat croissants, but I will keep that in mind.
I do. I do.
Next time.
Okay.
Whatever. I've cooked you enough food.
What does it mean? You've cooked me enough food. You have cooked me two things. I've worked for you for 2 years.
I brought you food to the office. Oh, my God.
Oh.
That is not true.
Seeing how the sausage
is
made.
Anyway, how great is it that Sandra Oh is cast as the lead in a major series, right? I mean, really, really, really great.
Thank you for bringing us back on topic here. Yeah, when Sandra Oh in interviews talks about how when she got the script, she had to call her agent to be like, I don't understand who they want me to play. Like, it never even occurred to her that she might play the lead, you know, because she had accepted the conditioning, the brainwashing that you will always be secondary, you will always be the best friend or the, you know, sassy sidekick or whatever. It never even occurred to her. She is fantastic. It is about time she plays the lead on something.
Absolutely. Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, she is super great. I also really liked the scene where she was in bed with her husband and was like, do you want to have sex?
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, okay.
Yeah.
And then she's like, work. Yeah. Oh,
do you want to have sex?
And he's like, I'm tired. She's like, oh, thank God. Yeah. Yep. Like, that whole exchange feels so real to me. Like, that is a thing that would actually be... Like, in a marriage, I feel like that would be how that communication would happen with these kinds of...
And that's what makes the show work for me right now, is that in the Sandra Oh sort of half of it, or part of it, it does feel so kind of grounded. And I hope that even as she becomes this, like, spy, it maintains to some degree that kind of grounding in, like, her as a real person with a real... you know, marriage, real relationships, because that's what's going to make and the show
the line
work
at the
for
end
me.
Where she's like, yeah, my husband would think that I was a secret agent before he'd think I was cheating. And the woman being like, maybe you should make him think you're cheating.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, I just that tension. Yeah. I was like, I hate deception like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I do with the villain character, too. I feel like what was her name again?
Villain. Conveniently, her name is Villanelle.
All right. We'll just call her Villain.
Yeah.
She I did like the moments where she's like goofing on her handler
just like that was great.
She's trying to like find connection. Yes. Like it's not subtle in any ways, but she's like, I want to bring someone with me on my work trip to like have fun with, and like she's trying to find connection, and she seems to only be able to find it through like, you know, maybe one night stands or just like with strangers. And It's this contrast of like she has been either she's a sociopath or she's been trained to be one, or, you know, we don't know the backstory, which I'm sure we'll get as the show unfolds.
Yeah.
But like she's lonely and disconnected from humanity.
And that's what makes that little moment where she and Eve actually cross paths and they're in the bathroom and she.
Oh, and her hair.
Yeah. And Villanelle says to Eve, well, she's like staring at Eve for a second. It's again, that kind of like studying of like, what? How does a normal person act? What does a normal person do? And it's to the point where Eve is like, are you okay? And then she says, you know, wear it down. It's, you know, one of those lovely little human moments. And also that cool, oh, they've already crossed paths, these two women kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Yeah.
I also wonder if there's going to be... like fallout trauma from watching, like when we don't know how much violence Eve has been exposed to in person. And so like, is there going to be sustained trauma or anything to talk about around that with the fact that she just like literally watched this person die in front of her and also all of these people like slaughtered?
Yeah. I mean, her reaction when she goes into that room is so real, like the panic, the horror. I mean, you know, it's like, wow, Sandra Oh is,
delightful.
She's great. Wow, yeah. She's awesome.
Shall we have some freakouts?
I am so down.
I love freaking out. It's my favorite part of every Monday morning. Ebony, you ready to share what you are excited or hate this week?
Yeah, and I am so, like, freak out doesn't cover it. I finally received my copy of Dread Nation by Justina Ireland, and I am just getting into it, and I already love it so much. It's going to be my favorite book ever. I'm just going to read you a little bit from the description on the book. Jane McKean was born 2 days before the dead began to walk the battlefield of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, derailing the war between the states and changing the nation forever. In this new America, safety for all depends on the work of a few, and laws like the Negro and Native Reeducation Act require certain children attend combat schools to learn to put down the dead. But there are also opportunities, and Jane is studying to become an attendant, trained in both weaponry and etiquette to protect the well-to-do. It's a chance for a better life for Negro girls like Jane, but that's not a life she wants. This book is going to be so bomb. I can't even explain to you how dope it is.
Are you freaking out about it? Wait, are you freaking out about it without having read it yet?
I just started it.
Okay.
Like, I'm freaking out about how good it is already. Justina Ireland, whatever, just brings the truth every day on Twitter anyway. Like, she's an amazing author and writer, the same word, whatever. Thinker, you know, cultural critic, like she, but her writing is just like, it packs a punch from the get-go. So like one of the blurbs on the back of the book is, Dread Nation is not your mother's Civil War era zombie story. Are you kidding me? A Civil War era zombie story starring black women? Give me more. Take my money. Cannot wait to finish this book.
We look forward to hearing your review of it once you're finished.
Yeah, who wants to be in a book club with me? Get into it. And it has the most beautiful cover.
I already have to deal with you every day.
Huh?
I don't want more. I don't want to deal with more of you.
Girl, bye.
I have to deal with you every day.
Bye, Carol. Carol, shut off her mic.
Hey.
Yes, please, take over, Carol.
All right.
Just for the record, I do love Ebony.
Oh.
We've been a little pissy this morning.
Don't try and save it. Don't try and redeem yourself in the eyes of our three listeners now. They know what I have to put up with.
They do. They do. All right, Carol, freak out.
All right.
We should have a, like, can we get the rights to the song Freak Out?
Oh, wow.
Can we just use it without the rights?
No.
Our producer just said no.
No.
Very sternly. I'm surprised there wasn't a period at the end of that no. All right. Sorry.
All right. So maybe just, you know, my deal this week.
Hey. Hey.
Thank you, Carolyn.
It's a single volume manga called My Lesbian Experience with Loneliness by a writer named, or a manga artist writer named Kabi Nagata. It came out about 2 years ago, roughly, I think, maybe a little less, and really created quite a splash when it was first released. And I've only just now gotten around to reading it and, really can understand why. It's an autobiographical work by the creator, and it's very, very raw and honest. At the time, she's like this 28-year-old queer woman who has all kinds of, like, she's very emotionally guarded. She has all kinds of emotional attachment issues. You know, she's never had sex, and she's, like, trying to sort out all these things in her life, and she... at one point she hires someone from, like, a lesbian escort / sex work service to kind of try to help, like, usher her through those things. And I just feel like we don't in media often see representations of those people who are somewhat, like, isolated and who have... sort of missed out on a lot of the formative experiences that other people have had, you know? Like, there's this kind of cultural assumption in certain circles and at certain times that, oh, everyone's been through... By the time you're this age, like, everyone's been through this, everyone's been through that, everyone's had this, everyone's had that, and it just isn't true. And I think that this is such a personal and powerful, you know, and also, like, I mean, funny at times, but, you know, really sharp... story about one woman who, for various reasons, was, like, really closed off emotionally and physically and sexually, and how she kind of tried to confront that.
Nice.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
My freak out this week is a show I went to, a musician named Moses Sumney. I saw him out in Oakland, and it was amazing. So if you're not familiar with him, I highly recommend checking out his album Aromanticism that came out last year. I'd say it's one of my favorite albums of last year. I didn't actually know until I was just doing a little bit of research for this freak out that aromantics and aromanticism is a real word.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's related to asexuality. Do people all know this?
Yeah. In the same way that we knew John Krasinski was on The Office.
Yeah, all right.
Carol and I are up to date on this as well, Anita.
Cool. Oh, you know what? Now that I actually look at the title, the word, I mean, it's right there in the title. All right. Anyways.
Girl.
I know. This is my life. All right. So, he's an LA-based artist, and I kind of describe his music as really, really good, sad music. He has this incredible vocal range and can hold notes forever. I want to read this brief description of his musical style by Moira Johnson in her review in Rolling Stone of this album. Sumney, a self-taught singer, can squeeze his voice into a whispered falsetto and multiply it into a pleading choir. His songs defy verse-chorus-verse convention while incorporating R&B's grooves and dream pop's hazes, rumbling stomach drones, and robo-funk synths. The show was completely sold out, and I got there, like, right before he started, so I was, like, squeezed in the very back, and I could only see teeny tiny bits if I, like, stood on my tippy toes, like, in the cracks between people's heads occasionally. But, like, it was amazing. So the thing about live shows is, you know, like, if you just play your songs as is, like, is it interesting? Is it engaging? What do you get out of a live show? His voice in person is incredible to listen to, and, like, he has this mic stand that is So, like, imagine a mic stand with a big bar across it, and there's five different microphones attached. And so each mic is set up with different effects. And so he'll use one or two mics together to create the different kinds of effects that are in his music. And watching that live on stage was really, really cool. Except for the one song he did completely in auto-tune, which I was like, yo, get over this shit. This is not good. But, like, it was really remarkable. And he did a cover, and I don't know what it was, but while he was doing the cover, I just kept thinking about Nina Simone. And I was like, and I never connected his music to Nina Simone or like my relationship to her music before until whatever that cover was, because he has that same kind of like brooding, tragic depth with like a lightheartedness. Like it's I don't know how to, Nina Simone is such a beautifully complex musician and so tortured. And I feel like his music is evocative of some of that in some ways. He asked, and like, he has a song about making out in cars, right? Like, even when it's just the topics are kind of almost, I'd say, goofy like that, even though it's not, because it's a part of this, like, the lyric is something like, I'm not trying to get you in bed, I just want to make out in my car, right? And like, It's really good. Anyways, at one point he was like asking the audience what they wanted to hear, and people were just like calling out all kinds of songs, and he was like, "Shit, y'all, I don't remember those old songs." He's like, "Some of you been around for a while," and so he was on stage like trying to remember the songs in front of us, and he's like, "Don't get your hopes up, because if I can't remember the like the chords or the chorus or the verse or whatever, like I can't do it." And he did eventually busted out, but like I thought that was a really nice interaction with the audience and like giving something back to this group of people who are super big fans. I will also say that when he first came on, nobody made any sound. The audience took like three songs before they actually like had any energy, and then once they did have energy, like it exploded in that room. But it was the weirdest sensation.
A Quiet Place. A Quiet Place.
Yeah, it kind of was, man. It was a little bit weird. There was another moment where he got the whole audience to have sing two different, like, I don't know music stuff. So, like, it wasn't a harmony, because he specifically was like, yo, this isn't a harmony, like, change your shit. But he got everyone to sort of hum in different tones, and it was really spectacular to listen to this, like, huge, like, almost choir-type sound booming in with his music. Wow, sorry, I have no words today. Anyways, Moses Sumney, Aromanticism is an amazing album. And if you see him live or if you have a chance to, I highly recommend it.
Yo, you should listen to Anita, because she's turned me on to a couple of folks who have made it into my playlist rotation. For real. Like, this is me being sincere. And you know, y'all, I'm never sincere. But you can trust you can trust her music taste. It's pretty dope.
Thank you. That means a lot. All right. That's our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Next week, Ebony and I are going to be doing a live show from New York City. We are being hosted by Kickstarter in their Brooklyn office, and we have very special guest, Jay Smooth.
So I can't handle it.
I know. Ebony's going to fangirl
lose my mind.
So we will have that for you next week. We couldn't make this podcast happen without our generous backers on Drip. Drip is Kickstarter's brand new subscription-based crowdfunding platform. Help us keep bringing this podcast to you every week by joining the Feminist Frequency community. We've got some great rewards for you, so pitch in now at d.rip/femfreak. If you are enjoying the show, we have a small favor to ask you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, because it really helps us spread the word about our show. And you know, when you are in the movie theater watching A Quiet Place, you should very loudly tell your friend sitting next to you, that they should check out Feminist Frequency Radio. Everyone will be so pleased that you did that. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all of our news. We want to hear from you, so hit us up on Twitter. Carolyn?
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
Ebony?
Gelato Punch.
And I am at Anita Sarkeesian. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. We will see you all next week.